American Pamela Druckerman thought she had a pretty good handle on what it means to be French, at least the stereotypes. You know, good taste in wine, a sophisticated sense of style, and a preoccupation with fine cuisine. Then she got married and found herself living with her English husband in Paris. A daughter followed, and when Pamela finally found time to take a breath, she uncovered another surprising aspect of French life. Wherever she looked, the French seemed to be employing a certain je ne sais quoi that was making their kids behave better than American children. Pamela Druckerman has written a book about all this. It's called Bringing Up Bébé: One American Mother Discovers the Wisdom of French Parenting, and she joins us from our New York bureau. Pamela, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Rachel.
Okay, so let's start off. Describe the moment when you realized that the French might have some kind of parenting wisdom that you could learn from.
It really was kind of an epiphany. I was on vacation with my husband and my daughter, who was 18 months old. We were at a restaurant, and she was refusing to eat anything but sort of pasta and white bread. And I suddenly looked up, and I realized that the French families all around us were having a very different experience, that their kids were sitting in their high chairs, enjoying their meals, eating their vegetables and fish and all kinds of other things, and talking to their parents. And you know, they weren't being seen but not heard. They were enjoying themselves.
What answers did you find? Is it just that French parents weren't giving their kids a choice? They were just saying, hey, listen, it's this complicated vegetable medley or nothing.
First of all, there is no category of food in France called kids' food. Kids and adults from the start eat the same thing.
There's no, like, hot dogs and French fries on the menu for the kids.
You can find chicken nuggets in the frozen food department, but that's not what kids eat all the time. My daughter went to what's called the creche in France. It's the public daycare. And I sat in one day on the lunch there with two-year-olds. There's a four-course menu every day. It starts with a vegetable dish, and then there's a main course. There's a different cheese every day. So I discovered to my shock that my daughter eats blue cheese. There are two things in that. One is that I think starting with vegetables is a really good idea, and we do that now. And the other trick that French parents do is they say to their kids, you don't have to eat everything, you just have to taste it. We assume that, I think, a little more that kids have inherent likes and dislikes, whereas the French view on food is the parent must educate their child, and that an appreciation for different foods is something you cultivate over time.
Which also speaks to another issue that you get at in the book, the idea of patience. Yeah. What do the French do that's different?
You know, I notice this when I go to the park in France, because I would usually arrive with a big bag of stuff to entertain my daughter the entire day, whereas the French mom on the blanket next to me would have just one ball. And she would talk to her friend, and the child would be happy. I guess that's what surprised me, is my child would need me to interact with her all the time, and French children seem to be able to play by themselves in a way. I see that when friends come over to our house, that the American families really seem to be constantly refereeing disputes between kids or getting on the floor and building Lego villages with their kids, whereas when my French friends come over, the moms sit at the table, we have a cup of coffee, we have a conversation, and the kids are in the other room having a great time, but playing by themselves.
But I have to say, that image of the French mom in the park talking with her friends and she's got one ball for her kid, that paints a picture of someone who's not exactly thrilled about parenting, maybe ambivalent. Or perhaps, you know, that's just the American take on this. But do you see it that way? Can you see it from the other side? How an American parent might say, well, listen, that parent just isn't as excited about playing with their kid, and I really like engaging with my child.
The French view is really one of balance, I think. That's what French women would tell me over and over, is it's very important that no one part of your life, not being a mom, not being a worker, not being a wife, overwhelms the other part. You know, this one mom was saying that she loves taking her kids to the merry-go-round because she puts her kids on the ride, she turns off her cell phone, she sits on the bench, and she just basks in the sun. She says it's like a spa holiday. And I thought, you know, I know that merry-go-round. It's near the Eiffel Tower, because I spend that whole half hour waving to my daughter every single time she comes around. As an American, you know, first I was really surprised by this kind of approach to parenting. But after a while, I realized, you know what, my daughter is proud of her independence. And I think that's really something that I've taken from the French parents I know, too, is that self-esteem comes from developing skills and being able to do things by yourself and from accomplishment, and not from this kind of constant encouragement from parents.
So I have to ask, no one really likes to be told how to parent. It's a very sensitive topic, no matter if you're French or American. What has been the reaction among your American friends who have kids to your book?
The response from readers to my book, and it's only been out a couple of days, has been just overwhelmingly positive.
Even from your friends have said, Pamela, you're kind of criticizing how we parent over here, but I get what you're saying. I appreciate your take.
Well, I'm criticizing myself. I mean, I'm probably the most extreme, maybe the more extreme example of an American parent. So I guess the book is really a memoir. It's my own story of how I partially became converted to some French ways of doing things, but also held on to the things I like about America. I'm never going to get the balance right, but I am trying to sort of pick the best of both.
Pamela Druckerman joined us from our New York bureau. Her new book is called Bringing Up Bebe, One American Mother Discovers the Wisdom of French Parenting. Pamela, thanks so much. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
It's Weekends and All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. In 1933, Senator Henry D. Hatfield, a Republican from West Virginia, wrote a letter to a friend complaining about President Franklin Roosevelt.
This is despotism. This is tyranny. This is the annihilation of liberty. The ordinary American is thus reduced to the status of a robot. The president has not merely signed the death warrant of capitalism, but has ordained the mutilation of the Constitution unless the friends of liberty, regardless of party, band themselves together to regain their lost freedom.
When Sally Denton came across that letter, it sounded amazingly contemporary. So she dug further and came across a whole series of attacks and even plots against FDR. She's written about it in a new book called The Plots Against the President. And the story begins just weeks before Roosevelt's inauguration in 1933. It was one of the darkest moments of the Depression, and many people in America were calling for a dictator to get the country back on track.
Unemployment is skyrocketing. The country is rocking precariously, economically, in all ways. And it's hard for us today to realize that in 1933, that the country was reeling. There were suggestions that capitalism was not working, that democracy was not working. Various intellectuals, and I mean not crackpots, were really considering the possibility of fascism, of communism, of socialism, of Nazism. The whole country was in play.
We often hear about the times just before President Kennedy was killed and how he was really vilified by his opponents, and some people suggest that that is what led to his assassination, that climate. You describe an almost similar climate in the early 1930s, 1933, that surrounded Roosevelt. Talk about some of the people who were sort of vitriolically opposed to him and what they said about him.
As I was writing this book, sometimes I felt like I could close my eyes and just transpose, you know, modern day vitriol to what was happening. There was this sense that Roosevelt was radically changing the relationship between the government and the governed. And there was great fear about that in many quarters, both the right and the left. So you had these enemies like Father Coughlin on the right, who was concerned that he was becoming a communist, a tool of Jewish moneyed interests. Then Huey Long on the left, who thought that he wasn't going far enough to redistribute the wealth. And then you had, you know, right-wing reactionary veterans organizations. You had Wall Street interests.
It's interesting because there was really genuinely a conspiracy at a certain point to overthrow the Roosevelt administration, to replace it with a kind of a crypto-fascist movement. And this was the people behind it were mostly financiers, bankers, part of a group called the American Liberty League. Who were they?
Well, they were some of the wealthiest people in America. I think the handful of people that were really behind the Liberty League controlled assets worth more than $40 billion.
They thought he was a socialist or even worse.
They thought he was a socialist. I don't know. A lot of times it was unclear whether or not they were able to even distinguish between what a socialist was or a communist. Or there was just this sense that he was upsetting the status quo.
These bankers were behind something that became known as the Wall Street Putsch. What was their plan?
They thought that they could convince Roosevelt, because he was of their of the patrician class, they thought that they could convince Roosevelt to relinquish power to basically a fascist military-type government. It was a cockamamie concept, and the fact that it even got as far as it did is pretty shocking.
How far did it get?
It got far enough so that they had had at least $3 million invested and claimed to have up to $300 million at the ready. They appealed to a general, a retired general, to lead it. And had he been a different kind of person, it might have gone a lot further. But he saw it as treason and reported it to Congress.
There are elements and themes in this book that seem almost to have been ripped from today's headlines. You know, talking about President Roosevelt as a part of a Jewish conspiracy, it sort of makes you think about the birther movement and whether President Obama was born overseas or if he's a crypto-Muslim. And did that occur to you as you were writing this?
Oh, absolutely. It was stunning to me that all these kind of paramilitary organizations and trying to prove basically that he was not one of us. I mean, this whole fear of the other and the demonization of Roosevelt has so many parallels to what's been going on in the country with Obama. And he was of Dutch Huguenot ancestry, and they were trying to prove that he was Jewish, trying to trace his bloodlines. You know, it seems to me that going through history here, there are times that we need to have a demon, somebody that's not of us, in order to solidify our fears and our anxieties. And I don't know what that is in the impulse of the American body politic, but the fact that this is 75 years later and some of these same impulses are continue.
That's author Sally Denton. Her new book is called The Plots Against the President, President Roosevelt, of course. Thanks so much for joining me, Sally.
Thank you.
In just the last year, 96-year-old American artist Elizabeth Catlett has had her work featured in exhibitions from Turkey to Mexico to New York. Yet she's still unknown to much of the general public. But NPR's Allison Keyes tells us young artists are using Catlett's technical expertise and her insights into gender, race, and class as a jumping-off point for their own work.
A man bends over a glass case, looking intently at the drawings of women with powerful legs and hips, the very act of their standing imbuing them with a force like nature.
Well, that's a woman right there.
Vincent Jackson is an artist. He's walking through the Bronx Museum of the Arts, exclaiming over Elizabeth Catlett's work and what he feels when he looks at the flowing lines of the figures.
Strength, you know, character. And the black woman.
That is one of the major themes flowing through Catlett's art, some of which was featured in the exhibition. But Jackson was stopped dead in his tracks by the 1968 Catlett sculpture, Homage to My Young Black Sisters.
That's her again? That is bad. That's the one I like the best.
That is nice.
It's one of Catlett's better known, a life-sized personification, in the feminine, of black power. It's a brown figure of a woman standing defiantly upright, fist raised in the air. But as much as Jackson loves the sculpture,
her I never heard of.
Catlett, as she said in a 2003 interview with NPR, is used to this.
I, as an artist, a black woman, artists have been invisible in the art world for years.
The show at the Bronx Museum was curated by Isolde Brillmeyer, who says when Catlett began creating, everything artists of color did was a struggle.
Catlett kind of came of age where African Americans and women were not part of the mainstream. They were not part of the center. They were relegated to the margins and were excluded.
Elizabeth Catlett, the grandchild of slaves, was born in 1915 in Washington, D.C. She won a scholarship to the then Carnegie Institute of Technology in Pittsburgh, but ended up at Howard University after Carnegie refused to accept a black woman. By 1940, Catlett had become the first African-American woman to receive a Master of Fine Arts at the University of Iowa. There, her mentor, American Gothic painter Grant Wood, encouraged Catlett to portray what she knew best, inspiring her to focus on black people, especially women, and their ongoing struggle for equality. Today, the 96-year-old artist says the work she's still creating in her home studio in Cuernavaca, Mexico, remains centered on women and those who are poor and disenfranchised.
I still believe in getting rid of discrimination.
Catlett wound up in Mexico after accepting an invitation to work at a printmaking collective. She married a Mexican artist and eventually became a citizen. The U.S. government denied her a travel visa for 9 years, declaring her an undesirable alien because she was a suspected communist.
Okay, so we're thinking that it's Egyptian.
Yes.
Back at the Bronx Museum, a class from PS 73 mingles with people walking through the exhibition. The Dawn Law is among them. She flew in from Pasadena, California for the show.
I just see reflection of all of us in her work. You know, like the Madonna, you know, I think about my own mother and how hard she worked to raise her children.
The show juxtaposed Catlett's work with pieces from 21 other artists, including Sanford Biggers. He contributed an oversized woodcut of an Afro pick with a clenched fist as its handle. In a panel discussion about the themes in the exhibition, Biggers called Elizabeth Catlett a trailblazer.
I think we have a lot more freedoms now because of the work Elizabeth and her colleagues did, her generation did.
Elizabeth's work has influenced me greatly.
Artist Xiveria Simmons had a photograph in the show called One Day and Back Then. It's a nude woman covered in black paint with a large afro and bright red lipstick.
That's Xiveria looking at Elizabeth Catlett.
Simmons says not only does she follow Catlett's focus on making work about what she knows, she's also influenced by its precision and clarity.
For me, Elizabeth's craftsmanship is unparalleled. I don't know anybody whose work consistently stays so rich and rigorous over such a long period of time. I've always looked to her work for that inspiration.
The artists on the panel said, like Catlett, they want to produce strong images that make people think differently about the historical struggles of people of color and incorporate what's happening today. Back in Mexico, Catlett is working with assistants and offering practical advice to artists trying to learn from her struggle and her work.
I hope they would learn to put in their best effort. They would learn to keep a contract on time. What else? Do a good job so they get another one.
Told that she'd been described as the matriarch of modernist sculpture, Elizabeth Catlett demurred, calling it too much.
I'm not the major art. I don't know who the major art is. I really don't know. I know it's not me.
Elizabeth Catlett once said she always wanted her art to serve as black people, quote, to reflect us, to relate to us, to stimulate us, and to make us aware of our potential. From the level of conversation, her work continues to inspire among both artists and admirers. It seems she has more than accomplished her goal. Allison Keyes, NPR News.
You can see some of Elizabeth Catlett's work at our website, npr.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin. The United Nations recently named Honduras the most violent country in the world. The government there is weak. It's a major stop for drug traffickers, and corruption is rampant. Many analysts say things got markedly worse there after a 2009 coup that ousted democratically elected President Manuel Zelaya. Annie Murphy reports on the struggle in Honduras to recover from the coup's fallout.
When it comes to coups and dictators, Latin America has a difficult past. But today the region is largely democratic. Dictators and coups are supposed to be a thing of the past. In Honduras, the last dictatorship ended in 1982. So the June 2009 coup that ousted President Manuel Zelaya was a shock to the region and a surprise to world leaders, including Zelaya.
The shooting started around 5:20 a.m. I went downstairs and there were about 250 masked soldiers around my house. All you could see were their eyes. I said, "My God, what is this?"
The military whisked Zelaya out of the country on a tiny plane and left him in Costa Rica.
They took off, and there I was, the democratically elected president of Honduras, standing in my pajamas in the middle of a runway in Costa Rica. And I said to myself, "So this is that great new future everyone is talking about for Latin America?"
Zelaya was speaking from his home in Honduras's capital, Tegucigalpa. He spent 2 years in forced exile. Last year, he returned home as part of negotiations for Honduras's re-entry into the Organization of American States, which it had been kicked out of after the coup. The coup itself was ordered by members of the Supreme Court and carried out by the military. Zelaya had been pushing for a poll to gauge public interest in rewriting the Constitution, and the court ruled that it was illegal. After ousting Zelaya, the coup government sent the army and police into the streets. They began arresting, beating, and even killing anyone who protested against the new government. According to an official truth commission, they were responsible for at least 20 deaths in the immediate aftermath. Edgardo Valeriano is a medical doctor and researcher. He'd never been political, but after the coup, he joined protests demanding democracy and Zelaya's return. Like many protesters, he was beaten. His skull was split open by batons, and police lashed him with chains. Valeriano says he feels like Honduras went back to the 1980s.
I remember those years well. I was a student in medical school back then, and I remember how some students would show up tortured by the police. Stories on the news about other young people that had been brutally tortured, whose bodies would turn up at different spots in the capital. There was an atmosphere of strong repression.
Former President Rafael Callejas ruled from 1990 to 1994, and his election marked the first time in 60 years that power was transferred peacefully between two major parties. He believes Zelaya is too brash, but says illegally ousting him has had huge repercussions.
We're in crisis. We went back 20 years. We lost again the issue of democracy. Who rules in Honduras now? Really, who rules? The people, the system, or strength? I mean, that's the question that has to be solved.
For over a century, the U.S. government has had significant influence in Honduras, from the era of U.S.-owned banana plantations to military and economic ties that endure today. Because of that history, the U.S. response carried a lot of weight. Fulton Armstrong is a former analyst for the CIA and was working as a senior staffer on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee during the coup. He watched the U.S. response unfold.
After the coup, a lot of the line that was taken by pro-coup people here in Washington was that the coup was the restoration of democracy, and they sold that in Washington. But when you look at what was actually happening in Honduras, he really was part of a continuation of halting, but definitely forward-moving consolidation of democracy.
Despite the call for Zelaya's return by nearly every other country in the hemisphere, Washington chose to back new elections, which were condemned internationally because of widespread violence and repression. Polls were held, and 5 months after Zelaya's ouster, Porfirio Lobo was elected president. Eventually, the crisis was declared over, but violence has only increased. Crescencio Arcos was ambassador to Honduras in the early 90s and has been involved in the country for decades. He says the Obama administration failed to take a firm position regarding the coup.
And I think that this stems from the following, that Latin America is an orphan in our foreign policy. I don't think we have a defined policy. We never defined, we had one during the Cold War. They were allies. After the Cold War ended, we never redefined, we never retooled.
Many here say the outcome of the coup is what pushed Honduras to where it is today, the world's most violent nation. Edgardo Valeriano, the doctor who was beaten by the police. It was shocking that in the 21st century, they could pull off a coup. The president can be taken out of a country and have his rights taken away without a trial or anything, he says. Then what becomes of your average citizen? For NPR News, I'm Annie Murphy.
Reporting for this story was supported by a fellowship from the Investigative Reporting Program at the University of California, Berkeley's Journalism School. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin. People from all corners of the music industry were gathered in Los Angeles last night on the eve of the 54th Grammy Awards. But instead of the fevered speculation about who would be voted the year's best artist, the conversation was all about Whitney Houston. The 48-year-old pop diva was discovered dead in her room at the Beverly Hilton late Saturday afternoon. NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates has more.
Houston died alone in the same hotel that was the venue for a party where she'd often entered in triumph, the annual pre-Grammy Awards bash given by her mentor, recording impresario Clive Davis. It was at Davis's A-list party that a teenaged Houston was introduced to the recording industry. And it was at another Davis party, says Billboard editorial director Bill Wordy, that an important milestone occurred.
I think it was just a year or two ago when she had her comeback album. You know, this is her big moment. This is where she took the stage again and performed and sort of made people realize that, you know, she could still sing.
Houston came from music royalty. Her mother, Sissy, sang backup for stars like Elvis Presley. Dionne Warwick was a cousin, and Aretha Franklin was her godmother. When she burst upon the music world in 1985, there was no doubt in anyone's mind the willowy beauty was a star.
Is all that we share. You've got your family. but no other man's gonna do. So I'm saving all my love for you.
Houston's striking looks and silky voice made her an instant celebrity. Music critic Stephen Ivory says her image was meticulously crafted by her mentor, Davis.
She was a voice, but she was the vision of Clive Davis. And Clive Davis is a big fan of ballads. This is his personal taste. And so when he found Whitney, he said, "This is my perfect instrument."
The instrument became iconic when Houston applied it to a Dolly Parton song that became her signature in 1992.
Life treats you kind, and I hope you have all you dreamed of, and I wish you joy and happiness, but above all this, I wish you
Billboard's Bill Wordy.
It was literally referred to as the note, right? That moment in I Will Always Love You where she hits the high note. I mean, no one can hit that note. I think there's probably like four people on the planet that can hit that note.
Houston's music was stellar, but her personal life was chaotic. Perhaps in an effort to escape the refined cage Davis had built around her, she married Bobby Brown, a former singer with the R&B group New Edition. The union was frighteningly volatile. Both Browns ended up in court on drug charges at various times, and many assumed Houston's canceled appearances and erratic behavior were Brown's fault. Music critic Stephen Ivory says they had more in common than people assumed.
I think they were two of a kind. I don't think that Bobby had any more to do with her spiral downward than she had to do with it herself. They were compatible, sadly.
Viewers got to see that for themselves when the two did a tawdry reality series, Being Bobby Brown. The couple divorced in 2007. Houston made a comeback 2 years later, engineered once more by her old protector, Clive Davis. Her album, I Look to You, climbed to number one, but her tour, with several canceled dates, was a disappointment. She recovered enough last year to take a lead role in a remake of the 1976 movie Sparkle. Her two last songs will be released when the movie is. Meanwhile, tonight, Grammy winner Jennifer Hudson will lead a tribute to the woman she says inspired her own career. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
For the troops injured in Iraq and Afghanistan, the deepest physical pain often comes much later, weeks or even months after the incident. That was the case for Sam Brown, who was badly burned in Afghanistan. But before we get there, some background. Sam graduated from West Point in 2006, and in the late summer heat of 2008...
Goodness. Yeah, we don't know hot like that.
He was deployed to southern Afghanistan to lead a platoon.
Deployment is sort of the pinnacle of service. In particular, combat is somewhat glamorized by Hollywood, and just it's considered a patriotic activity, something to be a part of. And I learned very quickly that it's not what it seems to be.
Much of what Sam's unit did was hearts and minds stuff, checking in on locals in Kandahar to see if they had adequate water, whether they were safe. It was hot, often mind-numbingly dull, and dusty.
We called it moon dust. It was just this kind of powdery dust that stuck to everything. No access to showers for a couple of weeks, at a time. And there were days where it peaked out at close to 130 degrees.
Now, before he deployed, Sam ran through a series of scenarios in his mind, scenarios of what might happen to him in Afghanistan.
Interestingly enough, the one drill I didn't run on myself was burning. And that just, for whatever reason, did not cross my mind as a potential type of casualty.
Sam's story is featured in the latest issue of GQ magazine.
I remember everything about the day I was injured.
That September day in 2008, Sam Brown's unit was called in to back up another platoon that came under attack. They were just approaching the site in Kandahar.
And we hit an IED right as we got to their location. And that was the beginning of a new life for me.
He's not knocked unconscious immediately.
That's journalist Jay Kirk, who wrote the article about Sam and reconstructed what happened that day.
He's on fire. He's down on his knees with his arms just flaming. His face is on fire. He's trying to put himself out, you know. He's rolling around as much as he can, you know, drop and roll. But he has a tactical vest on, so that's preventing him from putting himself out.
5 days later, Sam Brown was in the intensive care unit at the Brooke Army Medical Center in San Antonio. And almost immediately, to prevent skin infection, he was taken to a shower room where his skin was scrubbed by nurses. This is a regular, often daily part of burn care.
And it was as close to the same pain of being burned as I expect you could get. And it was a nightmare. And I thought, well, you know, when it was done, I thought, well, at least that's done. And the next morning, they woke me up and said they were going to do it again. And I wasn't prepared for that mentally.
He was put on a wide variety of drugs, including morphine, but nothing could dull the pain.
I mean, this is a drug that was invented in 1804, but there haven't really been a lot of advances in it since then. And there's a lot of really negative side effects to opioids. So, you know, there's nausea and constipation. It doesn't necessarily work on everyone. And then there's the tolerance level. So, you know, the more pain you're in, the more you need, the more you take, the greater the tolerance is, the less it works. And it's very dangerous.
2,200 miles away from San Antonio, two researchers at the University of Washington's Medical Center in Seattle were working with burn patients who, like Sam, weren't responding to pain medication. One of those researchers is David Patterson.
It takes a certain amount of attention to process pain, and if you're able to put that attention elsewhere, there's less attention to process pain, and consequently people will feel less pain.
Patterson and his colleague Hunter Hoffman were experimenting with virtual reality. Hoffman had been using a computer program with arachnophobes, a program where, by wearing special goggles, they become immersed in a world of friendly spiders. Patterson and Hoffman wondered whether a similar approach could work with burn patients. Here's Hunter Hoffman.
We created a world that was the antithesis of fire, the opposite of fire, a cool place, snowmen, pleasant images, just to try to do everything to keep them from thinking about fire.
They called it Snow World, and the Army was interested in trying it out with troops burned in battle, including Sam Brown.
I was quite skeptical. But I was also at a place where I was willing to try anything that might help.
That's because on a scale from 1 to 10, Sam's daily pain level often spiked at 8. So he put on the goggles and entered Snow World.
It was like watching a B-rated Pixar film.
Instantly, the world around him was populated with penguins and snowmen and woolly mammoths.
Everything about it was just cold and cool and cartoony.
And miraculously, being inside Snow World dramatically reduced the pain of his physical therapy.
Actually, they were able to move my arm and stretch it further than they had ever before to that point. And the pain was lower. So it was a very successful event.
Sam Brown spent more than a year undergoing surgery and in physical therapy. His face was reconstructed using harvested skin from his back. And during that time, he also fell in love. His dietitian, Amy, also an Army officer, is now his wife. And last September, almost 3 years to the day of his injury, they had a baby boy. His name is Roman.
I still, in my own mind, pictured myself for a long time as I was prior to the burn. But I'm at a place now where I picture myself as is, and the scars are really just a great reminder of who I am and the opportunity I've been given in life. It's sort of an external tribute or reminder to a new life.
Sam Brown's story is told by reporter Jay Kirk in the latest issue of GQ magazine.